You're listening to Fusion Patrol, a listener-supported podcast. Each week, we take a single episode of a science fiction TV series, movie, or audio and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. Welcome to the discussion. Hello and welcome to another episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm John.
And it's movie night here on Fusion Patrol, and we're looking at the 1981 science fiction film Outland.
Yay!
By Sean Connery. Synopsis. The titanium mine Con Am 27 is located on Io, where Marshal Bill O'Neill has recently taken his post. He's joined on the difficult posting by his wife and son, but not for long, because they ditch him and head back to Earth. His wife leaves him a note suggesting that he abandon the posting and return to Earth with them. There's trouble brewing at the mine in a series of mysterious accidental deaths. These deaths are preceded with bizarre delusional behavior, leading ultimately to death by misadventure. After the second death in as many days, O'Neill visits with Dr. Lazarus. She's an unpleasant sort, and she knows it. But when pressed, she researches the recent spate of deaths. She discovers that these regular occurrences of staffers bugging out started to increase dramatically about 12 months ago. The bodies have been quickly disposed of in space without autopsy. A hostage situation breaks out, and while O'Neill tries to take him alive, his right-hand man, Sergeant Montone, gets a bit trigger-happy and kills him. This time, the Marshal goes into the shuttle bay and extracts blood from the corpse before it can be sent into space. Lazarus analyzes the drug and determines it's a synthetic narcotic that allows people to work longer. But continued use causes the user to go psychotic. Workers working longer hours could be why Con Am 27 is the most productive mine on Io, and why the general manager, Shepard, turns a blind eye, or even perhaps facilitates the workers getting the drug. O'Neill checks the personnel records and finds two staffers with drug-related criminal offenses. Following them with video surveillance, they lead him back to Shepard and Sergeant Montone. He confronts Montone, who admits to being paid to look the other way. O'Neill says he's going to arrest Shepard, and Montone agrees to stay out of the way, but recommends that he doesn't try, because Shepard is very dangerous. First, O'Neill takes down the dealer and tries to get him to talk. He leaves him in a form of zero-gravity lockup. He confronts Shepard, and he tells him he's going to take him down. At first, Shepard thinks this is a shakedown, but when he realizes it isn't, he sets things in motion. First, the dealer is murdered in the lockup. Then O'Neill finds Montone has been murdered too, but at least he left a note telling O'Neill where the drugs are hidden. O'Neill is almost garroted to death, but takes out his would-be killer, and he finds the drugs, which he takes into his possession. When he tells Shepard that he's got his entire shipment of drugs, Shepard tells him he's a dead man. O'Neill has put a tap on Shepard's phone and hears the call to his suppliers requesting professional killers to be sent to kill O'Neill. They will arrive on the next shuttle in 60 hours. Everyone on the base seems to know what's happening, and O'Neill's attempts to get help from other police are fruitless. He makes his plans. The only one who is willing to help is Dr. Lazarus, by buying him a drink. The shuttle arrives, and a tense cat-and-mouse chase begins, with O'Neill pitted against two hired killers. Lazarus helps him trap one of the killers in a corridor, killing him when the section of corridor is exposed to Io's scant atmosphere. Hiding outside the greenhouse, he gets the second assassin to shoot the window out from inside, killing him. But O'Neill is not safe, because his new sergeant, Ballard, is also in the employ of Shepard, and after a tense battle in spacesuits, O'Neill disconnects Ballard's air supply, killing him. Turning inside, O'Neill confronts Shepard and flattens him. Afterwards, he sets out to catch the next shuttle to catch up with his wife and son for the return to Earth. The end. Outland. I'm going to have a fundamental question about this film at a very early stage, but let's just start with, what did you think of Outland?
You know, as science fiction movies go, it's a great Western in space.
Oh, we've already come to that, have we? All
right. Yes, yeah. I'm just going to go right there because it's pretty much what... There's two things that this movie is known for. First off, it's High Noon in space, which High Noon is a great movie. If you haven't seen it, go see it.
And this is not that.
Well, I mean, The Waiting Game.
That's the waiting game portion.
Yeah, that's the only portion, really, of it.
Yeah.
And that it's a sheriff waiting for a showdown. And the other thing this movie is known for is the gross misrepresentation of what explosive decompression looks like. Anyways.
Yes, it is known for that.
Yeah. As the director said, it was a balloon.
Yes, it was. And it's hilarious, too.
Yes.
I had this discussion at some different levels with Simon a few times. And I guess it's our opportunity to have this discussion because I can't decide if this is the least science fiction film ever made or the most science fiction film ever made. Now,
well, it is. It's one of those types of movies that the location is irrelevant for the plot. As long as there's a mine, as long as there's a bent manager and lots of bent cops around, you can make this movie any place.
Right.
It could take place in a coal mine in Pennsylvania. It could be in New York. It could be any place.
Yeah. And it's not just that it could be any place, but it is devoid of, apart from spacesuits, and, you know, and I guess the shuttle instead of the stagecoach coming in or the noon train or whatever.
Train, yeah. Yeah.
It's down to the fact it's shotguns.
Right. Yeah. Well, you know, they're safer in an enclosed environment when you got nothing on the outside of that wall.
So it is like...
Yeah, it's a fairly situationally generic story.
Yet at the same time, yeah. I would argue that probably, and I don't know what year for sure this is set in, but, you know, this is probably, well, a lot more like what it would look like.
Yeah, probably. It kind of has a space cops feel to it. You know, crime drama
Dark
just
cops.
Happens to be in space. Star cops. Wow, space cops? Jeez. Take a corner off my nerd card there.
Yes,
wow.
I'll tell you. Oh, yeah, sorry. But Star Cops, at least in every episode, had tried to make the crime something unique to space.
Yeah.
Right? This does not do that. This is just like workers, drugs, gun shooting, prostitutes. Okay.
Yeah, it's a solid 70s cop drug drama movie.
But because it is more likely, you know, I would love the future to be Star Trek.
And oh, yeah.
This is obviously not that far in the future. This is near future, the next century, or now this century, sometime later on, perhaps. And technology hasn't as advanced to get you there. Technology is advanced to get you down the mines, but people are still exactly the same. And the
right.
theme, you know, we don't have to have an alien attacking or
that
some
humans
monster they've unleashed.
Fine enough as aliens.
Yeah, the humans are monsters all on their own, and the technology. So in that way, it kind of is like, you could argue, well, it's if we had a mine on Io, there's the science part, right?
Mm-hmm.
Here is a fictional tale in that environment. What would that be like? It's like, it actually would kind of probably be just like this, but my mind still just wants to say this is not science fiction. But I can see the argument to the opposite side. It's just like, oh.
Yeah, it's this is that all-purpose story that somebody who has a TV series that they're producing has waiting in the wings in case something doesn't work out, where they can just, you know, pull this out and say, hey, we can shoot this. You know, sure, it was once a Little House on the Prairie script, but with a very short rewrite, it could be Buck Rogers.
I can see Pa Ingalls waiting to take out the bad guys coming.
Sure,
in. Yeah,
sure.
With some kind words and
instead of a covered wagon, it's a starfighter.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's yeah. It yeah. And I don't, you know, I watched this film in the 1980s. I didn't see it at the theaters. Older listeners will know that in the 1980s was the heyday, early 1980s, was the heyday of the mom and pop video rental store.
Yes.
And the way those used to work is that someone in your family would go in, get an account, get a card. They would leave a credit card number on file.
That's it.
So that you could go in with a card and it didn't have to be the person who checked it out. It's just like anybody in the family. So my dad was not always around the house when I was in high school. He liked to camp a lot. And so I was home alone for quite a fair amount. It didn't warp me at all. No.
And not at all.
So I'd go down to the video rental store and I'd rent all the R-rated films I could find that were science fiction.
There you go.
Well, and all the science fiction films, but you know, there's like those would be the same. This is one of them. Saturn 3, Saturn 5, this must be Saturn 3.
Saturn 3.
Was another one. Flesh Gordon.
Probably Demon Seed. I think they had a robot.
I think I missed that one.
Really?
Yeah, no. I don't think I've seen it, but anyway. So I've seen this film exactly once on a TV in 1984 or something. So I really came at this cold. Again, I remember the explosive decompression.
Yeah.
And the shotguns. That's what I remember about this film, was the explosive decompression and the shotguns and nothing else. And Sean Connery. I knew it was Sean Connery, but I sort of enjoyed it. I don't want to say I didn't enjoy it. Things happen. It's kind of an interesting, it's definitely visually very striking. That mine is fantastic. And I mean, the inside of the mine, the outside's fine too, but you know, the way they've designed that modular look is...
Mm-hmm. It's in the same vein as the movie Alien, which came out a couple years before this.
Mm-hmm.
That sort of, that modular, can't really call it sleek industrial design. It's very industrial.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of protruding bolts, a lot of preformed materials, stuff that you think that there's a factory someplace churning out thousands of these. So they just bolt them together to make a habitat.
Yeah, exactly. That's and exactly it's, what it feels like.
It's very much like when you see like an oil drilling platform in the ocean.
Yeah.
You know, just big. It's beefy. It's meant to last a very long time. It's meant to be repaired. So there's access panels all over the place. Yeah. It's very industrial looking. And many people think that this movie is probably set in the same universe as
Alien.
And that Con Am eventually became Weyland Yutani, or maybe they're a competitor.
I think you got a better argument that says this is the same universe as Capricorn 1. But
yeah, that too.
That is the same company, Con Amalgamate.
Oh, okay.
In Capricorn. Well, Capricorn 1, they were one of the contractors.
But that was also directed by the same man.
And written, yeah. And directed by the same man.
Written, right, yeah.
There's another film that he did that also uses Con Am.
Peter Hyam,
yeah.
Mm-hmm.
And Peter Hyam is on Young record
Cop,
saying, I don't remember what it is off the top of my head. Peter Hyam is on record as saying he wanted to make a Western.
Yes.
Period. I want to make a Western. And everybody turned him down. Basically said, man, nobody makes Westerns anymore. And to his own quote, and I'm not an exact quote, paraphrase quote here, you say, I apparently was the last, I thought it was really weird that a genre that had lasted so long and been so prominent had just disappeared. And then I found out, perhaps later than most, that they just moved into space and become the science fiction films.
Yep. So the New West.
So he turned it. But I mean, he has really gone with the, I'm making a Western and I'm going to keep as much science fiction out of the way as I possibly can.
Oh, yeah. You did a fantastic job of that.
It shows.
Yeah. Like I said, this is a good cop drama in space, you know, Western. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I, this is probably going to be sacrilege out there, but I am not always a huge fan of Sean Connery's acting, but I thought he was damn good in this.
Oh yeah, yeah. He can deliver a good. I don't know what you would call this character, stern but caring.
He can play a good cop. He's obviously a problem cop, or he wouldn't be sent out to this crummy location. But at the same time, he's introspective. It works. You hear the name Outland and go, oh, it's Sean Connery in space. Like, that's just not going to work. That is not Sean Connery's milieu, but it worked. He manages to do it.
Well, I think it works because it is essentially a Western in space.
But you couldn't get Sean Connery to do a Western in space, or Western, because, you know, we all know they didn't have any British people in the West, or Scots.
Yeah, yeah, it probably would have been set
not
in...
that were sheriffs. They could be like a prospector or shopkeeper or something, but you would never cast them as sheriff.
Yeah, maybe another 20 years they could have done something like that. Or they would have set it in someplace in India or something.
Yeah. You said it. Everybody says it. In fact, I mentioned this film to Simon earlier today, and he said, by the way, have you ever seen Outland? And his response in half a second was, you mean High Noon in space?
There you go, yeah.
And I'm like, well, yeah, that's the film. That's the film everyone calls High Noon in space. But, okay, let's take a look at this. High Noon, for people who haven't seen it or haven't seen it in a very long time, like me, and had to refresh myself on it. It takes place basically in real time.
Yes.
And it is an indictment on Hollywood blacklisting. That's what the film writer was kind of taking a poke at. The whole thing where, you know, your friends, when you got a problem, your friends are not, they're going to turn on you. They're going to betray you. Because that's what
no one has your back.
No one has your back when you get this whole communist thing going. So that part of it, I think John Wayne not just turned it down, but it's his most hated film. Communist or whatever.
Yeah, he knew that if he would have done that, that would have been a real black mark on his history. And he was. If I remember correctly, he was
a bit on the conservative side.
Yeah, pretty anti-communist.
Yeah. So, you know, this film isn't really that. Yeah. Yes, we have the halfway through the film, they go, okay, the guys are coming in and they're going to be here in 60 hours. And there's no way, thank goodness, that it is in real time from that point forward.
Yeah.
And he really, you know, the exploration of the High Noon is the interaction with him trying to get help.
Mm-hmm.
That really doesn't happen much in this film.
Yeah, there are bits and pieces
of it. There's bits of it. But that's not what he's preoccupied with doing.
No, no. He's more preoccupied in preparing for it.
Right.
And making sure that he doesn't get killed.
I don't want people to go, you know, every film with a clock is High Noon in space.
Because it's used a lot. You see the countdown clock a lot.
Yeah. And so, yeah, okay, there are killers coming on the stage. Yeah, that's the same. I can see the parallel here. Really, this film is more about, instead of being about blacklisting, this film's about corporate greed.
Oh, yeah. It's definitely about that. That's the primary driving element of the film, is that, you know, you have to keep the profits coming.
Yeah. And so that's... It causes this film to have a different emphasis along the way.
The greed of the corporate class will prevail.
Yeah.
That sums up a lot of this film, which, of course, you know, that might not be as emphasized by a lot of people who are working in the industry, the filmmaking industry, you could say that it's a bit like any large corporation is going to want to maximize profits over the people who are making the money for them.
Yeah, of course.
Equating it to High Noon is a little bit easier to swallow.
Yeah. It's definitely got that whole, it's Wagon Train to Space. It's High Noon in space. It's, yeah, it's very high concept, and it's like, boom.
Right. But
it's really.
But essentially, it is a cop drama in space, drug movie in space.
So since that's the only thing we have in this that's school unquote science fiction-y, the work harder drug. Let's just go with this concept.
Perfect end.
Okay, so they make a very nice connect the dots. It's like you take this drug, you could work, it's narcotic, you can work harder, you could work longer, you can do a double shift, you can do days on end, whatever, and you know, you've got the oomph to do it.
Right.
Okay. Which is great for profits, which is why Shepard, the general manager, is always going on about, you know, letting the guys work hard, play hard.
Right.
Are they getting stoned from this? I mean, what, apart from making you work harder, do people enjoy taking this drug?
It's probably very much like methamphetamine for, you know, what the Germans came up in World War II, Pervitin, which, you know, pretty much just gives you stamina. You know, you don't get tired. So you just keep working and working and working. And, you know, you take enough of it, either you will keep working or you drop dead.
Why are they taking it?
Because they get bonuses. They're all in on the bonus scheme. You know, it's all about the bonus situation.
Because that's not explicitly stated in this. There are workers who are taking the drug, and it's like, are all the workers taking it, or is it just some of the workers taking it? Do they do it for fun? Are they doing it? I don't know.
I think that based on what the doctor said about everybody was going to be having the flu in a couple of days, or a lot of the people, that a majority of the mining facility is taking this drug.
Now, that wasn't what I got from that.
Well, that's what I got from it.
Okay, so what I took from that was that everybody was, on the day the shuttle was going to arrive, everybody was going to be holed up somewhere where they didn't get shot.
Well, yeah, that's definitely the case. I did not think that they were.
Oh, I'm out of drugs, and now I'm gonna be.
Oh no,
having withdrawal.
No. Withdrawal would be after the shuttle had been there for a while. It sounds like you probably don't get withdrawal. You know,
well, that's
a couple days
point.
After it's been.
Everybody knows about it, but that doesn't mean everybody's taking it. Everybody knows the sheriff's going to get his head blown off,
right?
But that doesn't mean that everybody at the mine is taking it. It's just like all the cops. Are the cops taking the drug? They're all in on it, but they're not. Why would they be? Why would they want to work three shifts as a cop?
Right. Well, you know? they might not have jobs that would directly benefit from working like that. You know?
So that I kind of wanted to know. I kind of wanted to understand if this was like, hey, you know, Bobby, you take this drug and you're going to be able to work two shifts a day.
Mm-hmm.
7 days a week, or however many days a week you have on Io, and however long a day is, and you're going to get more money. What do you think? Okay, give it to me. Oh, I'd like the bonus. I would like to have understood what it was, or are they like taking this stuff? Because the guy who got it in his bunk, and you know, he had that sort of like, oh yeah, hit me with the good stuff, baby. You know, kind of. Like he's anticipating the high. So
I don't know. I mean, they don't really go into a lot of the actual physiological effects of the narcotic.
And what is exactly the definition? This, I hate to admit this, but you know, what exactly constitutes a narcotic? Is it a narcotic because it's addictive? Is it a narcotic because it has a deleterious effect on your state of consciousness? Is it, I mean, they definitely call it a narcotic.
It's anything that affects the mood or behavior. I think usually it's you know, as a sedative or a you know, something that would numb or something that would produce euphoria or something that would produce a heightened state of awareness or, you know, increased stamina.
Caffeine.
Right. Yeah. I'm not sure if caffeine would be considered a narcotic, though.
Yeah. What is the,
I don't know.
Thing that makes that the definition of a narcotic?
Well,
since I asked the question, I also looked it up on Wikipedia. Term narcotic comes from Greek, I make numb, originally referred medically to any psychoactive compound with numbing or paralyzing properties. In the United States, it has since become associated with opiates and opioids, commonly morphine and heroin, as well as derivatives. Primary three are morphine, codeine, and sebaine, which is only mildly psychoactive. So it's imprecisely defined and typically has negative connotations. So it sounds like it should be psychoactive in some way. I don't know.
Might be more of an amphetamine, which is something that would kind of wake you up and keep you going sort of thing. That's why I said it was more like the World War II German medication called Pervitin. I think in America, Dexedrine was what it was called. You know, stuff for pilots to take for very, very long missions.
Yeah.
So you wouldn't fall asleep after 14 hours in the cockpit.
Can't you think you just have them land somewhere and take a rest?
Sure.
Like hard a trucker would.
Hard to do when there's an ocean below you.
Pontoons.
There you go.
Man,
yeah, that's the answer for everything. In the movie...
Amelia Earhart probably thinks so.
Maybe. In the movie, it was called polydichloric euthymol, which, oddly enough, was used in the Terminator films as a high explosive. They used that to blow up the Skynet building, apparently.
So, yeah.
Probably shows up in other movies, too.
Nothing says I am putting an Easter egg in, like reusing some obscure pieces.
Oh, I know. That's a great piece, though. I love that.
Yeah.
That's great.
Let's see. This film was known for its innovative use of, and first-time use also, of something called introvision.
Yep.
You want to explain introvision?
No, introvision. That is a front screen projection system. That's where you've got the actor standing in front of a scotchlight background. Scotchlights is cool material that's made up of little teeny tiny glass beads that reflect the light directly back to the source. So if you project an image at it through a half-mirrored mirror, and have a camera pointed, yeah, exactly, and have a camera pointed at it 45 degrees, the image that's reflected back into the camera will be the actor superimposed on the background that's being projected onto it.
Isn't that like a Pepper's Ghost?
Yeah, it's very much like Pepper's Ghost. Yeah, except you've got... a picture in the background. So it's kind of like a reverse. But I suppose you could put a live action object in front of your Pepper's Ghost and essentially it would be like that.
And so they're doing that instead of, say, chroma key.
Yeah. Yeah. For some of the effects of the spacesuits and stuff like that. It's a pretty decent system. It's very fast and very inexpensive compared to doing regular matte shots where you've got chroma separation. I remember the movie Silent Running back in the early 70s. It was used with that quite a bit. And they pulled off some remarkably beautiful effects. You don't have any blue fringing around the actors or the spaceships, depending on what you're shooting. Yeah, it's fast. You get to see exactly what the shot looks like in the camera. So if you've got a video tap on there, you can get a daily with your effects shots right there. Directors must have loved it. I know it's used for about close to a dozen films. You know, like classics like Megaforce, Rambo 3.
Yeah. No, they shot first.
Yeah. But about the mid-90s, it was phased out because blue screen technology just got so much better.
Yeah.
And I guess... setting up the gear for everything to get everything just perfectly aligned was also a little bit touchy. So location shots were right out.
Well, fair enough. Yeah.
More technology that's no longer used.
My understanding is that the cinematographer, Stephen Goldblatt, was tricked on his hire, job, to basically, Hyams wanted to do the cinematography too. He was directing and he wrote it. He wanted to do the cinematography, but there were things, I guess, he did not know how to do.
Perhaps
with the Intravision, I don't know.
Exactly. He was not up on that. So it was new.
So Goldblatt, who was also only had one credit to his name at the time, was basically there to just cover for Hyams, and he was not happy about that. But he also didn't quit the job because he was young and early. But
So wanted to learn the process.
Behind the scene drama. Special effects main guy was John Steers. I saw that name. I have to admit, I saw the name in the credits, and I'm like, John Steers. Oh yeah, that's a big name. I can't remember where from, but I've seen that name so very many times on site. So when I looked it up, I'm like, oh, he's the guy that did all the Bond films up until The Man with the Golden Gun. After which Derek Meddings took over. Now, Derek Meddings was better than John Steers. But okay. But on the other hand, to his credit, John Steers was working on the Bond films mostly in the 60s. And Derek Meddings took over in the 70s when technology was newer and better and, you know, more advanced. So, if you remember those beautiful spacecraft and You Only Live Twice or all the exploding bases on Diamonds Are Forever, that's John Steers.
It does look like he did work on Star Wars. Martian Chronicles, Babylon 5.
Babylon 5, two episodes, the pilot, and one of the worst ever. What's it called? It's the one with David McCallum and the a bioweapon or something is takes over the base or it's the Invasion. Yeah, doesn't matter. Babylon 5
in Chitty Chitty Bang Bang, which has a child I greatly enjoyed.
Okay, Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. Think about it for a second. Who did Chitty Chitty Bang Bang?
Originally done by Ian Fleming, written by him, but
and produced by Kelby Broccoli and
The
Bond guys.
Oh yeah, yeah.
So John Steers is just their guy. Yeah.
Oh, I have very few complaints about the special effects in Outland. The space scenes, which really there aren't a lot of, done well. They're done well. They are decent. The miniature special effects are quite nice. Knowing the scale of the models that were used, some of the shots, like of the landing pad of the shuttle, apparently the pad was only 5 inches wide. So doing that shot is actually quite impressive. They must have been pumping massive amount of light on there to get the depth of field they got. But
Yeah,
it's visually, it's a nice movie.
Film.
As cop drug westerns in space go, it's excellent.
Yeah,
that's a new genre. I know,
it's new genre. And the only film in that category is Outland.
So it's the best. Exactly.
The pinnacle. It's been all downhill since. I have a weird note in here that I'm going to carry across is that his son.
Yes.
Is way too old to be calling him daddy.
Yeah, that's kind of weird. He also has a accent that doesn't match his parents. Like maybe they didn't flash his ROM with the right accent package. I don't know.
He's born in space, so that's a space accent.
Oh, it is. Yeah, that I don't know. I didn't follow up on whether or not that actor actually acted in anything else, but I kind of hope
ever
he
again.
Didn't, not very good.
It wouldn't surprise me if his last name wasn't Hyams, but
could be. Who knows?
It's all right.
There are a couple.
Jerry Goldsmith did the music too.
Oh yeah, you know the music really didn't have much of an impact on me. I don't remember any of it. It was just noise. Well, not noise. It was music, but it was just background.
Yeah, it,
I don't
it
remember
definitely blended
the,
in.
Don't remember the theme at all.
Nope. It is not. And, you know, Jerry Goldsmith is, you know, Star Trek, the motion picture.
Yeah.
That one rings. That one you remember. And I bet you remember some of his others, like Planet of the Apes.
Mm-hmm.
Even though that's weird.
Yeah.
he's a big, I would argue that, you know, probably the biggest name you're going to get in film scores is, people are going to go John Williams, but Jerry Goldsmith should be next.
Yeah, definitely.
Should definitely be next. So that, but you're right. It doesn't register.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean it's bad. It does not rise up like his other scores and become a character.
It's like something he knocked it over a week.
Could be. Well, you had some nitpick, I think you said.
I think the effects for Jupiter itself, it just looked like a big cloudy thing that was moving around.
Well, there it is, Jupiter.
Yeah, exactly. But back then, they didn't really have fantastic images of it. I mean, they had some, but...
Okay, so I do have to say this.
So
when I started watching the film, and, you know, they do the whole typing on the screen.
Yes.
They show you Io. And it's, did it? Io. And then in Perrin, they write, I don't write this.
I-O.
I-O. E-Y-E hyphen O-H. I-O.
Yep.
So that you look at this and you go, and my first thought was, seriously? How stupid do you think the audience is?
Well.
And then you learn that the working title of this film was Io, and that the video execs proved...
Exactly.
A terrible name by polling a group of people and found out that everyone thought it was 10 or low.
Yeah, exactly. Low, 10. What? Exactly.
And I have this sneaky feeling that there was an episode of Star Hunter Redux where they did something like that too. And I'm wondering if it was an homage to Outland.
Oh, maybe. Who knows? You might have to watch that episode again.
No. no. That is new. But I'm sure Kenneth is listening, and Kenneth is going to look that up for me.
Yes, please verify.
In his notes.
And get back to
my notes, for that matter. But those I still have. I don't know. I've got nothing else on this film.
I thought that when the hitmen showed up, and they just pretty much waited for everybody to go down their corridors, and then they just stood in the nexus of the corridors, opened their bags and assembled their weapons, and left the bags there, and then wandered off to go find O'Neill. It's like, were these guys figuring they'd be there for like 20 minutes and then hop back on the shuttle and leave? I don't get it.
Don't know how long until the shuttle leaves. That's a good question.
But that was kind of weird.
No, I don't know. It was... The other part was like, so, or O'Neill, here's an idea. Be at the shuttle bay with a shotgun when they get off the shuttle.
Yeah, then they could just keep walking, because he doesn't have any idea what they look like.
Be at the shuttle and put everyone in a tank and search them.
Now, that would be a good idea if he had more men, but he doesn't. And there's no telling who's on the take. Well, you can assume everyone's on the take. So, you know, he would just get knifed or something, who knows what. So
I don't think he did assume that everyone was on the take. And he was wrong.
I don't know.
Well, I don't know if he was.
I think he did. I think he assumed that, I mean, after he walked, this is later after he laid his traps and stuff, he walked into the cafeteria area and pretty much everybody turned him down when he asked for help.
Yeah, but for example, Ballard, when he asked him about who we can trust, and Ballard
was
like, we've got families,
mm-hmm.
and,
that was true.
That's a perfectly legitimate reason for not getting involved. I mean, it's a lousy one if you're a cop, but I mean,
yeah.
it's an understandable reason. You don't have to be on the take to be a coward or to think it's not worth it.
Oh, true, true.
So I don't know. I mean, I didn't think that in that moment he's going, oh, yeah, Ballard's on the take.
No, I think he thought that Ballard would be of some help. I think he was genuinely surprised when he met him out on the in space yeah. and started to shoot at him.
So, you know, they're not. He didn't think they were all on the take. There's yeah. one, and he was.
And I think he was probably surprised that Montan was not as bent as he thought he was after getting that message about where the drugs were hidden.
Yeah. Okay. Let's talk about that for a moment.
Okay.
Did Montan leave that note, or did the bad guys leave that note as a trap?
I think Montan did it.
Then why were they waiting there?
Oh, that guy was going there to pick up the drugs so he could distribute it. He was the distribution point of the drugs. So you had the guy who was bringing it in, making sure it got in safely, and then the guy that would distribute it to the people. Or he was the guy who was shipping it. He was going to give it to the guy who's going to distribute it.
The other thing, I don't know anything about these things, but that thing that O'Neill is wearing on his neck.
Oh, yeah, the neck guard.
The neck guard. I've seen this in other shows. I don't know if they're real. I assume that in some way they could be real. Somebody tries to garrote him, and he's got this thing around his neck, so he plays dead. Then they let him up, and then he beats the guy up. But the first thing he does is he rips the thing off. It's like, why would you take that off?
Yeah, I know.
That's like getting shot in your bulletproof vest and then getting up and going, yeah, taking the bulletproof vest off now, that saved my life. It's like, there are more bullets.
Well, if he didn't, if
there
he would
more garrotties,
it would have been a little bit difficult and long to visually explain why he didn't die after he'd been, you know, had a wire put around his neck. And taking that off just explains it right there.
Yeah. The other thing that I should mention, I did not verify this myself. This was in trivia somewhere, probably on IMDb. O'Neill, the first half of the film,
yes.
His name on his name badge keeps changing.
Yes. Yeah, that does happen a few times.
From O'Neill with an N-I-E-L to O'Neill with an N-E-I-L. As far as I know, no O-N-E-A-Ls. But
yeah, a little unfortunate bit of continuity problems there.
Two different people sewing the costumes.
I guess so.
No, damn it, his name's O'Neill I-E. It makes it unique. Like, okay. Or wrong. That would be the other thing.
Yeah, exactly.
Anything else?
No, not really. It must have been awful working there, though.
Oh, yeah, Io's a terrible place. I mean, you go outside, you explode.
No, I mean the crew's racks, you know, their beds are like apparently right next to where they keep their spacesuits and right next to where the door for the airlock is. So it must be just noisy all the time. That would be horrendous working conditions.
They've got their drugs.
I guess so.
Yeah, well, you know, it's visually very interesting.
Oh yeah, yeah. Definitely.
It does convey a very strong, like, space is expensive. Getting you in space is expensive. You don't get much room. You don't get any privacy. You don't get any good stuff. It has all that. Would it be like that? I don't know. I would think they'd at least have capsules.
Yeah, more privacy, more like a Japanese capsule hotel type situation. But yeah, they'd still be packed in there like sardines.
I think if you look at, and I'm definitely not counting this as the epitome of this is what space would look like, because we've discussed this before on Star Trek Strange New Worlds. They have some stupidly big quarters, but ignoring the fact that they have stupidly big quarters, they make up for having stupidly big quarters by putting the cadets in shared quarters.
Yeah.
That they have basically capsules.
Or like in
along the wall.
So the anime series Lower Decks, where everybody, essentially, they sleep in corridors.
Yeah,
bunks in the walls, so, corridors, yeah.
Well, Uhura in Strange New Worlds has a bunk in the wall, but it's in a, like a sitting room.
Yeah. Yeah.
And there's like four or six of them in that room.
Exactly. A little shared dormitory area. Yep.
But, you know, exactly. When it's closed.
Yeah, it's you get closed. Privacy. It's not, quiet.
You're not in a cage. Yeah. These guys are in a cage where they pulled out a little roller blind. So that, all right. It again, it's an anti-capitalist screed, right?
Yeah.
We want things to look as bad as possible.
Exactly. One step up from a prison cell.
Yeah. Except you're getting paid. You get paid in a prison cell, too. I think when you do a full day's work, you get like 2 or 3 cents. I mean, not
like
slavery.
That.
It's not slavery.
No, that's true. You're getting paid. True. Yep.
Yeah. All right.
But yeah, I would suggest anybody who is a true fan of science fiction watch this film. You know, you will be entertained, especially if you like Sean Connery and, you know, if you like Westerns in space.
You know,
or Alien. If you like that look, go watch this movie.
I do appreciate that this is a post Star Wars science fiction show that isn't trying to be Star Wars.
Yeah. Or Star Trek. Yes.
Yeah. It is something different. It is, as far as I know, unique. I mean, everything else that redone as a cowboy Western, you know, like, oh gosh. What's the film with John Boy and Robert Vaughn, and it's the Seven Samurai?
Not Battle Beyond the Stars. It's a
Battle Beyond the Stars.
Is that the name of it? Oh, geez.
Yeah, that's it. Battle Beyond the Stars.
Yeah, Seven Samurai. TV series Firefly.
Yeah. Yep. Yeah, there is that. that's probably the closest thing to Outland that they've ever made, come to think of it.
Yeah, maybe.
Yeah.
But yeah, give it a watch.
Definitely.
The copies you can get now.
Blu-ray.
Blu-ray, yeah. It's an excellent print. It's very nice. And I didn't even think it was like restored or anything. It just looks great.
Yeah. All right. Well, John, thank you for joining me.
Oh, you're welcome. This is fun.
And listeners, I do hope you'll join us all again next time on Fusion Patrol. You've been listening to Fusion Patrol. Thanks for listening. If you've enjoyed this episode, we hope you'll consider supporting us at buymeacoffee.com/fusionpatrol or patreon.com/fusionpatrol. For our monthly Patreon subscribers, we're currently running a special series on Babylon 5. Come join the conversation and find other content at fusionpatrol.com. And we're back on social media, where you can also follow us on Mastodon and the Fediverse. Our address is @podcast@fusionpatrol.com. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf. This has been a Lone Locust production. On the next episode of Fusion Patrol, we'll be looking at episode 13 of Space Above and Beyond, Level of Necessity, where Damp Mouse gets psychic powers. And we ask the question, yeah, what good is that when you're in the military? Come join the conversation on Fusion Patrol.